Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, everyone. Phoebe here with a very quick note before we actually get into this very special episode. There are spoilers ahead for the entire Percy Jackson and the Olympians book series, the entire first season of the Percy Jackson and the Olympians TV series, and for the end of the TV series Black Sails, if you ever plan to watch it, which you should. So, proceed with caution and enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Monster Donut, a literary and historical deep dive into the Percy Jackson series and all of its following spin-offs. I'm Emily, a classic scholar-ish.
And I'm Phoebe, a dramaturg and story consultant. And today we're joined by none other than the co-creator of the Percy Jackson and the Olympians TV series, John Steinberg. Hello, John. Welcome.
Hi, guys.
First of all, this week, by the time this episode comes out, season one has officially ended. So congratulations in advance. You have successfully put The Lightning Thief to screen in full, and it's wonderful.
Somehow, yes.
It's been so cool to get to see the way you all have sort of taken this story and brought it forward. Like, every single change, I feel like, has always made me think, which I love. I'm so excited by that. So I'm so excited also, hopefully, fingers crossed, to see where a lot of the stuff you're laying out is going, too.
Yeah, like I've told you before, but I'll say it again. I really appreciate seeing this story told by people who clearly have a lot of respect for the story and for the heart of the thing, but are also looking for ways to enhance and build on what already existed there. That specific approach is really exciting to watch, to see you all finding new pathways through this story.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's I think that's how you show it your love, right? Is by trying to figure out how to add things and help it transition into a totally different form. I really do. I know, sort of talked about it a lot in the last couple of months, but I really do believe that if you try to port over a format, a medium, into an entirely different medium without being willing to go through this exercise, you just kind of end up with something that doesn't feel like it wants to be the new thing. It doesn't want to be a show or a movie or whatever we're calling this. It feels like the shorthand we used in developing this was, we never wanted it to feel like a tribute band. We never wanted to feel like somebody playing the Percy Jackson covers and sort of appealing to nostalgia and nostalgia only. We wanted for it to feel like it was a living, breathing thing that captured the soul of the original form and frankly all the way back to the words on the page, captured the feeling that you get from reading it, but knew that it was going to have to exist in a different body, I guess. So it's good. It's a good feeling, and I think it's heartening to see that in its new form it's speaking to people who knew it already and speaking to people who were just meeting it this way.
And I can only speak for the people who grew up reading it, but I do think you've really captured the heart of the story. And in a way that's also making me think about what that heart is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, trying to, the more familiar you are with something, I think sometimes it can be a little hard to, it can be easy to lose sight of where its soul is. You know, you're kind of used to its rhythms and used to the things it's doing. And so I think it's been a healthy mix of people who know this, you know that book upside down and backwards, and people who you know, came to it a little later and can apply a different lens to it.
Speaking of people that know the books upside down and backwards, I think one of the most interesting things to me about this particular adaptation, in a way that's probably a bit different than what you've done before with books, is the fact that you had the author in the room with you. Not only initially, but like as full parts of the conversations, having both Rick and Becky be part of the process of bringing it to the screen. So I was curious how that impacted the way you approached the series.
Definitely new. You know, I've had a kind of a relationship with an author or with somebody who, you know, came to the material having been there before and having created it, but never like this. It's interesting. You know, I mean, I think even if Rick and Becky had decided they didn't want to be a part of this and weren't so involved, I think I probably would have come to it with a similar measure of awareness that this isn't mine. You know, that the property, the story is something that that someone else lives in and has lived in for a long time. And, you know, trying to be respectful of that and aware of it. I think having that person there to show you around the house and to, you know, I think make us all feel welcome in this story, especially knowing that they'd had a rough experience the last time anybody else had kind of been in there trying to execute this process, has been really important and I think was critical to being able to find this. You know, to go through the process of being willing to change things, but knowing that you had some guardrails and a compass to know when you were heading in the right direction. So they were really good hosts, I think, you know, in the story to help, you know, make that possible.
Yeah, and I find that I feel at least that I can see their influence throughout the show. and it's wonderful to see. I'm curious too, though, since this isn't your first time dealing with a pre-existing text or well-loved characters or stories, since you've done it a couple times now, is there a specific way that you find yourself approaching a book when you know you're bringing its characters or its story to the screen? Like, have you developed any kind of adaptational philosophy when you're looking to translate a story like Percy's or Silver's or Dan Chase's?
It's a conversation, I think, with the story. I think anytime I read anything, with very few exceptions, I'm having instincts about, you know, what I like and what I understand less and what feels interesting to me. And a lot of times involuntarily, like, I would have done this differently, or, you know, what if this was connected to this? Or the conversation comes from the sense of, what are my options here? You know, when it's a job, what are my options? How, and I don't just mean in terms of a rights holder or in terms of, you know, anything that, mechanical, I mean, in terms of an audience sometimes, you know, with Treasure Island, I felt like I had a little bit of leeway. Book's been around for a bit. And I think, in addition to it being, you know, 100 and however many years old, that story was really about reinterpreting story. And so you come into it knowing that you have not just sort of some freedom to move things around, but that's part of the idea, as part of the conceit, is to suggest that that the narrative is compromised. This is the first one I've come into and really sort of felt from the beginning a not just an obligation, but a desire to stick to it, to kind of give an audience a thing they desperately wanted. And I think we're entitled to, you know, I mean, I think there's IP of this size gets put on screen a lot. You know, it's kind of part of the landscape right now. And this was one that for, you know, for a lot of very understandable reasons, hadn't been through that, and you know, wanting to do it justice, and I think make the experience of seeing it as a fan something enjoyable and fun and not damaging, I think. But you know, I think with this one, I felt it. You know, I felt sort of the desire to really start planting flags in the ground around things and feel like, all right, let's show this. This feels like something if I had been reading this book for the last 15 years, I'd really want to see. At the same time, once you start writing scenes, sometimes the pieces don't line up anymore. You know, you've removed connective tissue and you got to figure out another way to get from here to there. So, you know, I guess this is all by way of saying they're all different, but I think in some ways they're all similar. They're all, you're just trying to see your way through. How do I write these scenes? And how do I make you feel at the end of this thing like you went on a journey you didn't have to consult a book for along the way, and that it stands on its own feet.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that the idea of Treasure Island being sort of compromised and that you don't know how to trust it. But also, Percy Jackson is a story that is being told by an extremely opinionated and biased 12-year-old. So I guess I'm curious, since Percy isn't narrating this show, how do you find yourself managing adapting something that does have such a specific tone and voice to it that the entire story is being filtered through in the book?
I mean, that's right at the top of the list of where this exercise gets is a challenge, that so much of that book is in his head. You know, it's not just told by him, but it's told by him to him. And I think it took me a minute. I think Daphne was part of this conversation to sort of realize why, you know, there were moments that I think I was having a hard time figuring out how to port over literally. And it's because you say things in your head you'd never say to another person. They come off differently. You say it in your head and it's charming or it's snarky or whatever. You say it to another person and you're just somebody nobody wants to be around. And so, you know, finding that new balance of how do you express this tone that is Percy's voice and his way of seeing the world in a way that is and not monologue. And I think that was just by feel, you know, just trying to understand him and where he's coming from and what he means when he says these things in his head and finding new ways to say them.
Yeah, I actually, a long time ago, probably like 10 years ago now, I once went through The Lightning Thief and like cut out all of his internal monologue and just looked at the dialogue that he was actually
What
speaking
was
aloud in the
left?
actual. It was like he doesn't talk all that much actually, and it was a fascinating experiment.
I can be honest, I confess I didn't notice it when I read it the first couple of times. Like I didn't really notice it until I got into writing these scenes and started feeling this tension between the voice that I felt was in my head from the canon and the voice that I felt like needed to somehow express itself on screen. And then it hit. It was like, oh, that's why. You know, because this isn't just a you know, from a novel to a screen adaptation kind of an exercise. This is taking something in a head, you know, in a kid's head, so even more unfiltered in some way, and figuring out how to make it sound right. So yeah, I'm surprised there's anything left. I'm trying to remember all the stuff in the
No, we talked for a long time about how like he goes on for paragraphs and paragraphs in the first chapter, and then his first spoken line of dialogue is that like dead serious, "I'm gonna kill her." And you're like, "Weren't you just telling me jokes 2 seconds
Yeah.
ago?"
Yeah. And imagine meeting that kid, right? Where he hadn't said anything. And that's the first thing. So it's like you start to get a sense for how you know, this translation is really it's happening in every moment. You know, you hope it's invisible, but it's really there's energy applied to every moment of his experience to make it work in this medium.
I'm curious also, were there any particular breakthrough moments you can talk about where you felt like you found the voice initially?
That's a really good question. Yes. Can I remember what they are? I'm not sure. I mean, there's so much material that kind of flows through this that it all eventually starts to blend together. But there were definitely moments early on of finding things that felt like the screen Walker Scobell, this show version of that voice that both matched the voice of the book, but were new. It's interesting that frequently when I felt like I found it, they tended to be the things that walked right up to the line of feeling like they were too far. You know, I think there was a little concern about the acorn joke, about the pine cone. And to me, that was a little bit of like, oh, okay, I think I'm starting to get it. And there was a little bit awfully insensitive. It was like, wait, isn't that kind of the idea? So, you know, it's, I think part of what makes the book so compelling is that he is always walking that line of being somebody who has an edge that is, it's not off-putting, it's endearing, but you got to ride the line to get there. And so I think part of the breakthroughs were sort of finding that line again, you know, and finding something that was going to be charming because of how irreverent it was, but not so irreverent that it made you know, not want to be around him anymore.
That's funny, because that line to me, I remember feeling like, oh, it was sort of a reminder to me, like, oh, he's 12. Like, he doesn't really have that lived experience yet of like, maybe I should be a little more sensitive about
Totally. And this is
this.
all, I think, you know, at that point in the story, I think he's still a tourist a little bit. You know, and not fully. To me, that was the underlying subtext was that this, in some respect, this wall wasn't quite real yet. Like he'd fought a Minotaur and he'd done all the stuff and he saw the Oracle and but there was something about it that wasn't quite his yet. You know, quite plugged into his head. And that was a little bit the spine on which the season was hung, was getting to a point in the middle of the season where it does become his. And these things aren't, like, I don't think that's a joke he'd make again, you know, in the second half of the season. I think that's a door you walk through once where you feel like, wait a minute, I think this is as much about me and for me and affects me, as anyone.
To that end, a question I had, because I went back and I was listening to a lot of your interviews on Fathoms Deep, and I noticed how much you talk about mythology in the way you think about story. So I was really curious, since myths play a much more literal role in this story, if that at all impacted the way you were thinking about it. Or like, were there myths that don't come up in The Lightning Thief that you found yourself still thinking about?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think both in sort of the high altitude sense, right? Like I think the it's hard not to think about Odysseus in some respect, when you're looking at the story. You never want it to feel like you're cribbing off it because it's a very different kind of story, but it's there. There's times when it's specific. You know, I think the Hera's throne, the Golden Throne, was something that was a little more specific of a piece where it felt like, oh, you know what would work really nicely in this moment is this other story that's prefab. Like I didn't make it up, but it just kind of slots into that space really nicely. Having Daphne Olive around to find those pieces and put them where they belong is really helpful. But yeah, they're always there. I think it just removes that part of the filter, I guess, where when, you know, on sales. It was always in the back of my head, but you can write about it. Like it just was sort of scaffolding. And here it's the star of the show. So it's a little bit easier to use it, I guess.
Yeah, because I've also heard you talk about, like, speaking of Odysseus, like, I've heard you talking about, like, Achilles and Odysseus and, like, the Kleos and Nestos of it all, too, which we've talked about a little bit as well, just at the premiere, and I asked you about it, I think, in our press conference. And I've always also found that, like, divide pretty funny personally, because basically one of my favorite stories is about a Spaniard named Vasquez. But also, one of my favorite stories is a good friend of mine. When we were starting college together, she ended up being randomly assigned the person that would end up becoming both of our advisors in classics. And on literally the first meeting with this professor, she said, "Oh, I think I want to study this." And the professor sat her down and said, "Okay, well, the first thing you need to know about classics is that there are Iliad people and Odyssey people, and you have to pick one." This is less than
Really?
one. Yeah. And you know what?
You're made of.
Right. She was right. 100%
I don't know. I feel like some attribution is necessary. Like this is my undergraduate class on classical heroes with Greg Nagy is all of this. Like, and I never stopped thinking about it. But I feel like they're in conversation with each other. I feel like you know, it's always it's never gone away, I think, from the way I think about story, that these two poles exist, this sense of wanting to go home and withdraw from the world in favor of comfort and in favor of security and safety and whatever you want to call it, and this call to walk away from that in favor of some different kind of meaning and legacy and glory and all of those things. And you could talk about this for days. I mean, I think that that's how sort of how simple those two poles are, and also how elemental they are. And I feel like there are things that are always a waypoint in my understanding of a story I'm trying to tell, is when I understand where those two things are operating in the story. And I think one of the many things that I think is really clever and pretty about the way Lightning Thief is structured is it's fully having that conversation in every moment. You know, specifically, right? It's like I am going on a journey to either find my mother and bring her home and be her little boy again, or save the world at the expense of her and move into another part of my existence. Like, I don't know how else to articulate that divide any more cleanly. So yeah, no, I think I would take issue with you have to choose one or the other. I think they're two halves of the same conversation. So to be under I think to understand either one of them, you have to sort of be fully engaged with the other.
Yeah. That being said, I'm still going to ask you if you had to pick one.
I don't know. I always connect to the Odyssey a little bit more. I don't know what that says about me, but I think the pull of home, I guess, is really compelling. But I don't know that I've ever read that book or experienced it without thinking about the other. You know, I feel like I assume this is sort of, I mean, maybe I was the last person to find this out, but there were a number of them of Odysseys from of other characters in the Iliad going home, and that's always sort of something in the back of my mind too. That, they feel like this kind of, these two hemispheres of a story, but it's just because those are the ones that survived, and there's all these other ways of thinking about getting home. So that also kind of lives in the back of my head sometimes too, to not get too wrapped up in the models, as if they're the only ways to tell a story. They're a way to tell a story, but not the only.
That's something that I thought was also interesting when you're talking about like the Treasure Island stuff, because I always think about like it's for me, storytelling and myth and classics are so connected to each other because that's sort of like what we know about storytelling at its root comes from what we know about classics at its root, because that's sort of I mean, for better or worse, the Iliad and the Odyssey are two of the oldest written stories we have. And so being able to trace it all back is something I've always found like just so fascinating of like what is the beating heart of what, kind of haunts us as we move through life that is like continued on from such ancient times.
I think when a story hits that tone, pitch, frequency that makes you feel something that's so true, it kind of ceases to be about what you're watching, and it's just this sort of sense of feeling a connection because of how deeply felt that moment is. And then when you feel it amongst a number of people, so you're hitting something that's a really shared experience. I feel like those are the kind of stories that keep sticking, and I feel like that one way to look at classical mythology or any of those kinds of stories is those are the ones that are so true they just won't go away. They're touching something that is so universal to human experience that can't be avoided. It has to. It's rooted in being born and separating from another human being, and all of the kind of things that you can't be a human being without going through. And so I think another one of the things I love about these books is it's taking all of those things and making them fresh and new again. Which is pretty cool without undermining any of the truth of it, which I think is great.
I'm trying hard not to talk too much about Luke because we're gonna get into Luke, and once we get into Luke, we will stay there. But I do feel like we can't talk about Klaus and Nessus without bringing him up, just because we had a longer conversation about it well after watching 102, because Luke, it seemed like had sort of convinced himself that Percy was a glory seeker like him, but in truth, all Percy was really looking for in that episode was like a place where he fits and that he can call a home now that he's lost his mom. And that was sort of the first of many mistakes he would make and will make when it comes to trying to predict Percy. And I felt like I could see that part of the theme like so clearly in that episode, and I loved it. But I also think, I mean, it's interesting to talk about in relation to like characters like Annabeth, who, I mean, we also had a long conversation about this when we read in Sea of Monsters, Annabeth tries to swim home, and those two like sort of conflicting sides of Annabeth, where part of her does think that she can like rebuild the world and do it better than anyone else and leave her mark in that way, but at the core of it is also the fact that she's so driven by trying to bring her home and her family back together, especially once Luke leaves it.
Yeah.
So I guess the question in me just talking is, where else are you sort of feeling that, like, Kleos-Nostos dichotomy?
I mean, everywhere. That's not a cop-out, right? I think they... Annabeth is an interesting flavor of that story because the idea of going home for her is so freighted with the lack of all of the things that should drive homecoming, right? Like the lack of comfort, the lack of security, the lack of certainty. Home doesn't mean any of those things for her, really, or not in the same way it does for Percy. So her conversation between homecoming and glory seeking is misshapen, I guess, a little bit because of her experience. Luke, I think it was really important to engage with all of that because it felt like I wanted to understand how, when I got to the twist, spoiler alert, you know, that you didn't feel, it wasn't the end of Scooby-Doo. Like, it wasn't a moment of someone pulling a mask off and you feel like, oh, they were pretending to be somebody else. There's not a scene in the show where he is pretending to be anybody other than who he is. He's actually being super forthcoming with Percy from the very beginning about the way he sees the world and his irreverence towards authority and. Like, he's basically saying everything except the punchline. And that just felt like a way of seeing that relationship and specifically that character that had legs, that made it a little harder to dismiss him as a threat because it wasn't just the physical threat. There's the sense that at some point on Percy's worst day, some of those arguments were going to find foothold, you know, despite the fact that they don't really find one in the second half of the first season. I think the suggestion of the ending is that battle is far from over. And I think it comes from that, right? Like the more maybe you don't have a sense of a feeling of security and safety and all those other things in homecoming, the more the glory seeking sounds like a pretty good gig. So, you know, I think that was sort of the landscape in which that Luke story was conceived for this version of the story.
Yeah. One of the things I found the most striking about this version of the betrayal too is the fact that Luke, he to him, Percy is going to be on his side. Like, he doesn't believe, at least at the beginning of the scene, he does not, he believes by the end, but you know, he doesn't believe that Percy's, I think Phoebe even pointed this out to me, he doesn't believe that Percy's going to say no. And in a way, he's like trying to build that community with him.
Yeah, like part of the way the Charlie and Walker are, you know, they're amazing. And I think part of what they brought to it was that, right? There's a way to watch that scene and feel like that Luke thinks he's just opening a door for somebody who's already knocking. And there's a way to look at it where Luke knows he's wrong and is kind of hoping that someone will say it, you know? That there's this weird sense of not guilt exactly, but this I don't know, an awareness that he's the bad guy. He can't figure out why he's the bad guy, because everything he's saying makes sense, but I think he knows it a little bit. And so that to me is an interesting bad guy, you know, somebody who is so desperately trying to be anything but. And I think it really is like wired into, I mean, I'm sometimes curious how I would watch the show if I hadn't read the book. And there are moments that are so loud to me, and especially in 102 in the camp scenes, of feeling like, you know, in this place that's so sacred and is a space that God's made, to hear these two older boys joking about the gods in that way feels so irreverent to me. Like, it feels so like they're advertising that, you know, something's wrong here. But I know where this is going. So I don't have fresh eyes into that. But yeah, no, I mean, I think part of that whole experience was him feeling Percy out. Because, you know, is this somebody who can hear the truth, you know, as I see it and buy into it. And clearly he felt like he had found someone who could, and he just missed. Or Percy's experience with Annabeth and Grover brought him back from some kind of a ledge he could have been pulled off of if Luke had made that pitch in a different way.
A ledge at the edge of a pit.
Yeah. Well done. Yeah, exactly.
I did find that probably one of the most fascinating parts of that dynamic in the show, because it is such an essential relationship to the series, and you've really built on that Bond, it felt. And like, it, you've crafted it in a way where it felt like it wasn't just Percy feeling the betrayal in that moment, it was Luke too. Because at least in my interpretation of what I was seeing from Luke, it seemed like he really thought that, like, you know, he'd found or built a partner out of Percy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, this runs together for me, so I'm not positive, but I don't think in the book that Annabeth is there at the end.
Yeah, no.
Right? Yeah. And so I think that is probably why I'm having some of that feeling, is that with Percy, because this is all news and because he sort of only knows the parts of Percy that have been shown to him in this short amount of time, he can tell himself, I'm right. I know I'm right. And then the moment Annabeth is looking at him, the moment he's observed in that moment, I think the guilt is so apparent, because she heard him saying things that I think he knows are a betrayal of her and everything she believes in. And so I think that was important too. You know, having that dynamic, the Luke and Annabeth family dynamic, really kind of get turned up in the mix, and turning up Luke in the mix in 102 and trying to give him as much material in 2 as we can, just kind of, I think a lot of that was Annabeth's in the book, and we felt like there's plenty of time for Annabeth to have her moment. Like, this all needs to be, you know, in service of making sure that by the time you leave camp, Percy feels like Luke is his best friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Luke and Annabeth relationship, I have thought a lot about this since watching 108, because in the book, he is so often a blind spot for her, and that Percy just can't understand that. And in the show, their dynamic is particularly interesting to me, because rather than learn about their relationship through Annabeth, we have learned it through Luke's point of view, that she's his little sister, and that he's always on her side and all of that. But we only sort of get pieces of that story from Annabeth herself. So I do want to ask, who is Luke to Annabeth in your mind? And how does this new version of the betrayal scene sort of play into that? Because she actually has a role in it now.
I think Luke occupies sort of a range of functions for her. You know, I mean, I think he is, he's obviously her big brother, to the extent that has any inherent meaning in this context. I think he is her oldest friend, I think, in a meaningful way. He is not a peer. You know, I mean, I think her desire to act up, to be competent and stoic and older and sort of present as being an adult, basically, I think comes a little bit from feeling like a kid around him. I think, you know, for somebody that doesn't really have authority figures in your life, having this one authority figure who is so anti-authoritarian is a weird head trip, I think, probably for her, that will take her quite some time to sort out. But, you know, I think that betrayal is trauma, right? I mean, I think to feel like there's this, you know, your mom won't talk to you and your dad kicked you out of the house. And like, you know, I think there's, you know, already a complicated relationship with authority. And then to have this one person who felt like they were in your corner turn out to be dishonest in a really material, intimate way, it's hard to come back from. And exciting, I guess, as storytelling, to think about where that goes over, you know, the next 4 seasons of this iteration of the story. And what does that 5th book look like, you know, when you've got all of that material built up with a different kind of torque behind it and crashing?
I personally was thinking a lot about the Titan's Curse after watching that, just knowing what Luke does to her in that book.
Yeah. Yeah, and right? I mean, it's like we're sitting in this moment that's I think as weird for us as it is for an audience of feeling like before you watch the show, the books exist whole, right? It's one experience. Mm. In the middle of it, the books exist in this dual state of having been like 20% rethought. And so you look ahead at what's going to happen in those next 4 books, but it's all going to get this treatment, right? It's all going to sort of like become a part of this story. So it's, I don't know. It's strange to sort of look at this and feel like, oh, we've been told 20% of the story. We've been told 20% of a story that is going to track what's left, but it's not it, literally any more than, you know, than this first book was. So He'll still do all, they'll have all the interactions from the 4th book, but I'm sure it'll feel a lot different than it did in the book.
Yeah, I'd like it to. I'd like to see where you can take it. That'll hurt me even more.
That's our job.
I think coming back to these books as well, as we've been doing, has really like opened my eyes to how many different lenses you can look at them through and how each one sort of leads you to different things. So I really am enjoying the fact that the show is taking me on a lens that I haven't thought of.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's like it's so subject to that turntable, I guess, that I feel like you have to be able to experience a story through, where as the light changes, all of the suggestions and subtext and all of that change with it. If it's sturdy enough, it'll hold up to that. You know, you can look at it in any direction you want to, and it's just as interesting. So I think that was sort of the goal, was to give it that next dimension.
While we're talking about Luke, I do want to talk backstory, because we got hints of what happened to his mom. Not the full story at all, but just the smallest pieces of it in 106, rather than, you know, season 5 when it comes up in the book. So I'm curious, where did that move come from?
Some of it's unavoidable, right? I mean, I think Rick has been open that there are things that happened in the later books that he just hadn't thought about when he wrote the earlier books. So when you receive them all as one canon, it's all a fair game. And then once that's a part of who Luke is, it becomes hard not to talk about it. You know, it becomes difficult not to address the fact that in the midst of Percy's really complicated search for his father and for his place in the world, that his new best friend and mentor's relationship with his father and understanding of his place in the world seems pretty relevant. I think, you know, pulling Hermes into the casino, putting him on screen, and making him the voice of this, where did that come from? I think that, I think it was interesting to me to meet Poseidon through a number of different audiences, you know, people kind of explaining to us who they thought he was. And that sort of sense of, you know, what this authority figure in the family told me about parenting was just this really hard thing to say no to in this story. You know, of really, I think in a way, aside from Sally, you know, kind of explaining why she was so enthralled with him, the first person who's kind of going to bat for him and saying like, you should really consider giving him a break because it isn't easy for him either. You know, in a story that's about a kid learning to understand his own growth and, you know, his own sort of movement towards adulthood, I think a part of that is seeing your parents as adults also and seeing them as people. And somebody had to say that to him. I think somebody had to say, you think everything is a certain way, and I'm telling you, it's so much more complicated than that. So it was coming from both directions. You know, I think it was sort of wanting Hermes to be a part of the story for that reason. And because Luke was so important to it, you know, so important to Percy's journey, wanting that connection to feel like it had mass in the middle of the season and substance. And, you know, even when you're getting away from Luke's story and he hasn't been on screen for a while, he's part of it. You know, he's a part of Percy's journey that he's never really going to be able to stop thinking about.
The reason I'm asking is that this is one of the changes that I've been thinking a lot about, because that question of like what happened to Luke is to me one of several centers of the series. Like with it comes the entire Annabeth Thalia Luke relationship, but also like his quest for the golden apples and also what happened to his mom. And it's like only once Percy understands all of that that he's really able to see Luke clearly in the end. And you've introduced it in this really interesting way where it only suggests what might have happened, but almost in a way that, like, I mean, you could walk away from that thinking, like, I don't have the full story, but you also may walk away from it thinking, I have enough of the story to understand Luke, and not realizing that you really don't have any of it.
You just said it, right? It's like, I think you understand Luke as well as you should in this moment. I'm kind of, just as like a story management issue, I think I'm really mistrustful of deciding on backstory for the sake of itself. I feel like I try really hard to let the story decide what the backstory was. And I think in that moment of season one, the story demanded that we understand a certain amount about Luke and we understand a certain amount about his relationship with Hermes, but it wasn't demanding anything beyond that. And any more sort of details we applied to it felt like that's me monkeying around with stuff just to sort of, you know, make it make it feel detailed, but it's not helping your experience of the emotional journey of this story. And so I avoid it. I really consciously kind of avoid, I'd avoid even answering your question about what I think happened then, because I think what happened then is going to reveal itself through Percy's eyes, really, and through the present day lens of the story as it moves forward. But yeah, I think you get the guts of it. I mean, that is a severely broken home. And I think Luke's experience of having a divine parent was somebody who not only couldn't protect his mother from awful things, but may have had something to do with it. That sucks, you know? I mean, that's a pretty awful way to grow up and think about your dad. And I think just that idea is more than enough to understand how you get to Luke in episode 8.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like this series made me think about the gods as parents specifically in a way I hadn't really thought of them before. And I think that scene really, like, the way Hermes is in that scene, it's like very humanizing, but specifically in this one sort of element.
Yeah, I mean, I would, not to like descend too far into it, but like, I think one of the things that makes some of these stories so universal, the experience of someone who is larger than you and retreats to other places you're not allowed to go to and makes decisions you don't understand and is stronger than you and has been around for longer than you. Like, we've all done that. Like, that's the experience of being a child. And the idea that these stories that are about that point of view are so old and so hard to shake and feel so true, I can't imagine that they aren't connected. And so I think in us trying to embrace that idea, we're not adding anything, I think, that's not already a part of it. I think just the idea that, you know, the ultimate unknowable authority figure is also dealing with the tension and difficulties and complications of being an unknowable authority figure feels both in the soul of a story about the gods and also really specifically human and about a parent-child relationship.
I want to switch gears a little bit just because I want to make sure we ask this particular question. because speaking of Luke, I couldn't help but notice the parallels between season 1, episode 8 of Percy Jackson and season 4, episode 9 of Black Sails. With, for those who haven't seen Black Sails, the episode opening on a sword training flashback that's used as a framing device for the eventual conflict, what I am calling the dual-dual structure.
Nice. Well done.
And I was really curious why bringing that structure to Percy Jackson, and also generally what about it speaks to you, because I love it. It's great to see. But yeah, like, I'm curious what brought you back to it.
I don't know. I think the only way I really understand how to figure these things out sometimes is just feeling them out. Like, you kind of keep staring at the materials on the table until they start to take a shape. And sometimes the shapes are familiar. Is that because I had done it already and kind of knew what it looked like? Or is that because there's something in the DNA of their dynamic that was suggesting it? And so there's some kind of convergent evolution happening. I don't know. Aware of it, you know, very aware of it. And I think always a little bit hesitant to lean into it too hard. But there's just something so clean about, you know, I think you'd only known Luke for like 6 pages before he's introduced as, you know, the best swordsman in camp, and that's his thing. And that the idea that the moment in which he's kind of feeling out who Percy is and is this somebody who's going to listen to what I have to say is happening while he's also kind of seeing what he's made of and seeing how he responds to being pushed, and felt clean and right. You know, the structures are similar. The outcome is sort of pretty different, you know, and all its beats are different. But I don't know. I only have one head. And so sometimes stuff comes out of it. It's connected to other stuff. I don't know how to sort of fully preempt that.
I will say what I was getting from it was I kept flashing back to the line about, like, by teaching someone how to fight, you are teaching them how to defeat you.
Yeah.
Like, that was what was playing in my head that whole time. I was, partially because it was playing into my sort of interpretation of this relationship in the show, with Luke seeming to trust Percy a lot, and that he has to trust Percy a lot to actually take him out into the woods and teach him how to fight.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a conversation to be had of watching all of these shows and then trying to figure out how they're commenting on each other. I'm sure they are. But yeah, I think there's some truth to that. You know, in terms of the more you try to teach me what you know, the more I'm teaching you what I know, you know, and teaching you how I react, teaching you how I react. Maybe that's part of it too. You know, maybe part of it is wanting to sort of, I think if I'm trying to make it really simple, I think I just sort of like the idea of, formal, opposition to each other before it becomes substantive. This idea that they're opponents with weapons who are on the same side, you know, before they become opponents in a much more visceral way. It's just kind of an elegant way of, framing it, I guess, framing you know, what these things that are, you know, that are a problem for them, you know, that are a problem for Flint and Silver and that are a problem for Luke and Percy exist while they're friends and they're standing there with weapons in their hands and these differences exist. They just haven't exploded yet. It's kind of an interesting tap dancing on a landmine kind of a moment of, you know, at any moment it's going to blow and then we're going to have to actually deal with this. This is an interesting tone.
It's interesting because one thing I was thinking, I've been sort of slowly working my way through Professor, is it Najee?
Naj, yes.
Naj's class, or the 24-hour hero. And I came across one line that I thought was really interesting, where he was talking about how, like, Heracles, or Hercules, is named after, like, glory to Hera. And it's basically, the connection he draws is how the antagonist in mythology shapes the hero, arguably the most out of anything beyond the hero's deeds. And I read that line and I immediately thought of Flint and Silver and that scene in the woods. But then hearing you explain it now, it also made me think, like, oh, I think that is the connection for me, at least, with Luke and Percy as well. It's like how they as each other's antagonists shape each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're, Flint and Silver become, those two characters, I think, become enmeshed in each other. In a way where they're kind of each leaving a mark on the other. That story is a little different, I think, because one of those people is sort of defined as being a vessel who will kind of, is more predisposed to accept those kinds of things, is looking for things to belong to. Percy and Luke, I think that situation is colored a little differently. But yeah, I mean, I think when this is working, right, I think the dynamic between, you know, protagonist and antagonist or hero and villain or whatever you want to call them should be doing that. You know, I mean, I think they're all stories about ourselves and stories about how, you know, you wrestle with the things in your head. And so I think the dynamics of those characters should be approximating that they're fully opposed to each other and still really connected and part of the same conversation.
Well, since we're coming up on an hour, final question, maybe looking toward season two, but also looking at what you have done in this season. I do want to talk about how you've written Thalia into this season, because Thalia's presence in The Lightning Thief and The Sea of Monsters has always been a favorite subject of mine to get lost in, because she, to me, feels kind of like a ghost haunting the story, because she is haunting like everyone around Percy, Annabeth Grover, and Luke. And he's hearing her story from all of these different perspectives, and she's in his nightmares. She's just kind of built into a myth in those first two books. And so I want to ask generally about how you've chosen to depict Thalia in this first season, but also specifically about 104, where Annabeth talks about how she feels Thalia made her earn her affection, which Percy immediately rejects and compares to the gods. And I just kind of the image of Thalia that we're building and that Percy is building in this season. I think there was a question in there somewhere.
You just put a question mark at the end.
Yeah.
I think that in a way is a little bit what we were just talking about, is that in that moment that just felt true. That like in a conversation that's really defining a lot of Percy and Annabeth's ongoing meet cute, I guess, they're sort of each other. Which is, you know, I'm trying to figure out what unconditional love is and if it exists and if it's meaningful and if you're entitled to it, that it feels so clear that in some respect, Luke is that for her. He says it, I'll always be on her side and I don't, you know, there's no question, there's no getting between us. immediately, if you tell me she has another best friend, I want the other thing. And I kind of want to hear that, there's a different kind of unconditional love, and a kind that comes with a little more mistrust at the heads of it, a little harder won. And so that presented itself really in the context of that scene. I don't think there was any, that wasn't tracking a decision we had made. Like there wasn't this picture of the show's version of Thalia that scene was referring back to. I think there was a picture of who Thalia was that we deliberately left. Let the clay remain soft, I guess, as it were, and kind of waiting for the story to tell us who what kind of shading she wanted. So I think if I'm remembering right, I think that's kind of how it happened. But it feels true. And the moment you hear her say it, it feels true. And it's like, well, that's part of the story now. And so I think some of the fun of season two will be watching Thalia come into focus in this story, through the lens that this story wants to understand her through. And I think when she de-arborizes, I don't know, like whenever she manifests, she's going to be Thalia from the books in the same way that Percy is Percy from the books, but she's going to have this other color, I guess, to her that comes from the very specific Percy and Beth and Luke story that the show is telling.
Yeah, like she has that whole myth built up around her, and then she appears finally, and it's like, now I have to recontextualize everything that I know about you and figure out who you
I
are.
also like, I mean, Annabeth is so standoffish, I guess, or hard to know in the first couple of episodes. And Luke is so clearly not that. And so it immediately suggests, like, where's she getting this from? What experience is this a reflection of? And the idea that there was somebody who's even harder to know and even more kind of a tough nut to crack. Immediately, I start leaning into Thalia even more. It's like I want to get to know her, and I want to put her in a room with this idiot who somehow won Annabeth over. But like, it's not gonna look like. Just feels like fun story to look forward to.
Amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. This was so much fun.
Happy to.
Fingers crossed for season two and beyond. And everyone listening should go watch The Old Man and also Black Sails now that the season is over. Yeah, thank you. Thank you again for coming on.
Of course, this was great. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Thank you all for listening to another very special episode of Monster Donut.
And thank you, John, for joining us.
Yeah, huge thank you to John for taking the time to join us when he is super busy doing a million things. Next time, we may or may not have something else special planned, so stay tuned. But in the meantime, we are going to be doing our wrap-up eventually. So send in your questions or analyses, anything we missed. We love reading everything from y'all, and it's so much fun to get to talk about it in full once it's all out in the world. So this will be a special wrap-up because we, unlike the rest of them, haven't known how it ended until we when we hit the wrap-up.
Yeah.
So yeah, and you can do so. You can email us at monsterdonutpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram. And we are at PJOPod on all of those socials. So if you want to DM us a question, you can also leave your questions on Spotify, where you can respond to this or another of our season one episodes.
Also, thank you to all of our patrons, RK, Winda Wells, Emily Ann Bonney, Roman Consul, Latino Kaya, Patty VCK, Bethany from Public Works, Sydney Fox, Joke, Reina Avila Ramirez Arellano, Charlie McNeil, Bronte Laveau, Chief in Plays, Robert Gamer, Kels, Kari, Layla Hussein, Mason Bowman, Casey Cassidy, and Evelyn Zamudio. Now that the show is over, I have so much more time to actually edit and post all of the things that are supposed to be up on Patreon. So, including reactions, spoiler episode. I went back and looked at that the other day. Oh, in our 108 recording, Emily went off for like 30 minutes about...
Literally 30 minutes. It was
literally
30
minutes straight about the various ages, like the Golden Age, Silver Ages, etc. Some of that conversation is in that episode. Some of it is not because it was 30 minutes. So if you want that full conversation, I'll probably also post that on Patreon.
You want to just hear me rant until I devolve into incoherence. That's what it actually is.
It was all very interesting to me. It was just 30 minutes long. So if you would like to join our Patreon, you can find the links to do that in our link tree, again, on all of our social media at PJOPod. Well, see y'all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.